what I would look at is what went wrong in David's life. I don't wish to pull David's life to pieces, but rather look at the kind of things for us to look out for when they happen to us, and how things could go wrong for us if we're not careful or prayerful. Whatever things went wrong, we know that the Lord picked him from the dead and Saul disobeyed God. 1 Samuel 13 and other places say that David was a man after God's own heart. For most of David's life, he was a man after God's own heart, that is true, but he had lapses. Seems to me, if one pleases God as a lifelong attitude, then it looks as if God will overlook things, even when they're very big lapses. The key to this grace is whether we love God or not. David's life has, in my view, about five eras. One, from his birth to the age of 30, when Saul died. From 30 to 37, when he was king of Judah in Hebron. 37 to, I would guess, around 50, as king of all Israel in Jerusalem. At about that age of 50, when he lapsed badly, this dark period seems to have lasted around 9 months, which is the time from conception to the birth of his boy. And then from the fifth episode is from his lapse until the death of 70. I'm going to do two things. First of all, I'm going to summarise these 5 periods, and then I'm going to go into a little bit more detail. Period one, up to the age of 30, it seems to me David did very little wrong when he was really up against problems. And it showed he was a man after God's own heart, with his forgiveness too. And his soul loved to put Saul, who didn't deserve any of it. From 30 to 7, David was crowned king in Hebron, and he won the hearts of all Israel with his gentle attitude to the house of Saul in particular. Then, 37 to the age of roughly 50, when he was king in Jerusalem, he felt secure in God's protection, started to become complacent, and so made mistakes. He also seems to have been scratching around for things to do. For instance, he was denied the plan to build God's temple. Although his attitude was great, he must have felt empty of purpose, a void in his life. And that's the sort of thing that did lead to a midlife crisis. Then, of course, there was that famous lapse with Bathsheba, and the famous cover-up leading to the death of Uriah. I wonder if they ever prayed to God in all that time. The midlife crisis had come to an end. Then the fifth period, Nathan the prophet comes with his parable, which David thinks the man who the parable was guilty, and he is suddenly told that that man was David himself. And from there on, David's love for the household of Saul remains as it always had. He also has the same love for the very undeserving Absalom. But things go wrong many times. Sometimes his own fault. But sometimes I just think he just lacks the confidence that he had in his early life. Here are the details for the 5 eras. When he was born, it was a poor start, it might have been, not of David's making. Some folk have said that Psalm 51 verse 5 hints that David was born out of wedlock, because it says, it said my mother did conceive him. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but he wouldn't be the only man born out of wedlock. There was Jephthah in Judges 11, verse 1, and even Jesus born out of wedlock. And a common feature of these births is that their brethren despised them. They were not disposed to that irregular birth. Jephthah's brethren threw him out. Jesus' brethren did believe on him. And it seems to me David was well aware of the attitude of Eliab, his eldest brother, when he said in frustration over the business of the battle of Goliath, "What have I done now?" Some of these brethren become reconciled to the one born out of wedlock. I certainly believe we've seen Jesus' brethren eventually came round. Then we read about his early faith. David tells Saul about how the Lord saved him from the lion and the bear. David is the good shepherd, saving his sheep. And with that, armed with great faith under God's strength, he saves David's, God's sheep, the Israelites, in battle, in particular the one with Goliath, but there were several others. As a result of David's victory over Goliath and the young girl's lauding David as being better than Saul, Saul is full of envy, and he goes absolutely mad in his pursuit of David from 1 Samuel chapter 8 onwards. Despite all this, David loved Saul right from the beginning as his soothing physician and his armor bearer. And right at the end, when Saul perishes, he actually calls him lovely and pleasant in his lamentation. And I think he meant it. But lovely and pleasant, I'm not sure that Saul ever was that. I doubt if there's anyone on this planet who would ever loved his enemies more than David. Back with Jesus himself, of course. So the question is, did David do anything wrong at all in these years? Well, we've got one thing. He killed many, albeit on God's behalf. So that can't be wrong. In fact, it was right at the time. But it's not what Jesus ever did in his lifetime. And the fact that David was a man of war stopped him building his temple. There were other little niggly incidents as well. Did David really need to deceive Achish of the Philistines? Or is there a point, even under the umbrella of God, where we may think we need to do something a little dodgy? God overlooks it. Or the case with when down to the priest in if man does not live by bread alone, does David need to go get bread from the priest? And the result of that, 85 innocents lose their lives. Strangely, Jesus declares him guiltless. It may be, of course, that David was looking after his men who might not understand man does not live by bread alone. I'm not sure you can think any of these are big faults or faults at all, but they are niggles. The only thing really of note is Nabal in 1 Samuel chapter 25. It's as if David's great passion with Saul snaps with Nabal. Never try the patience of a patient man, is the motto outcome of that. Anyway, David made this stupid oath to take revenge. God, through Abigail, delivered from David from carrying this out. So it's a lesson for us. We can do all things well, but sometimes something gets the wrong end of our wrath, our patience is really rattled and tested. And the straw that breaks the camelback happens then. The same lesson, which is backed up by the New Testament particularly, never make oaths, or God might require it of us. God might, but he might not, deliver us from our own sins by stopping us doing what we planned, the prince and will. And Abigail, through God, stopped David. But that chapter is in the middle of two chapters about David's deliverance of Saul, chapter 24 and chapter 26. And in chapter 24, God places Saul as a sitting duck for David to rid himself of the problem once and for all. Question: if God puts a gift horse in your mouth, do you refuse that gift? And would you be wrong to accept it or to refuse it? Now, David refused it, and he showed mercy on his enemy, and he actually put his own life into peril at the same time. Following up on that incident is Abigail, who Abigail shows David the truth. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. What happens then? God says Saul upon the plate again, and David refuses again. Was Abigail a timely reminder for David that David must not have the Lord's anointing? Maybe because he was the anointing one in waiting, or maybe because he was Christ-like, forgiving nature. But whatever it is, you look at those first 30 years and you think they were wonderful. He becomes king in Hebron, and there's not an awful lot to say here, except that David's love extended to Saul and his family. And it was shown by his anger at the murder of Ish-bosheth, and it was shown by his anger at the murder of Abner. And there was a long battle between the very respective armies of Saul and David. Abner started them, then Abner surrendered. But it was, generally speaking, it seems to be an orderly business to reunite that country over that 7-year period. But then I start having doubts. What about Michal, the daughter of Saul? You remember what had happened is that Michal had been given away by Saul to somebody else. And what David demanded of Abner was to have Michal brought back. By which time he was already married to several other people anyway. You have your doubts about this, but it probably follows the rules of the town. If you get the woman, you get the kingdom. But then I think, what about Michael's husband, Baltiel, who followed David as being husband in the first place? Did David really need to take Michal off Baltiel, who was weeping at the time? I wonder what God really thought about it. It wasn't the only time Michal suffered the hand of David. First of all, David refused her any children. And secondly, David executed the 5 sons of her sister at the time of Jim Gibeon. It's an altar business by this man of God. Then David seems to be biased against disadvantaged folk. You know what? He loathed blind folk, and he loathed lame folk. The Jebusites used that as a way of trying to stop him conquering Jerusalem. It didn't work because David ignored the talks. What's the conclusion of this section? Is that David acted well most of the time, but there was some real ugliness about it. But David remained faithful to his forgiving nature. Era 3. This is from the age of 37 to when he lapsed. He was king of all of Israel in all Jerusalem. king of all Israel in Jerusalem. He finally got the kingdom fully for himself. You might think that when you get comfortable like that, you've got your health, your financial security, you've got your faith, or you believe in the right thing, you may then be complacent and forget to pray. This might have happened to David. There was a couple of verses that really stick out in my mind. And David has seen that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he exalted his kingdom for his people, Israel's sake. Followed by, and David took him more concubines, wives, out of Jerusalem, after that he was come from Hebron, and there were yet more sons and daughters born to David. That pair of verses, I think, is no accident. Nor is it an accident, it's recorded both in Chronicles and Kings. Just an aside, of the six sons of Hebron, three turned out to be no good and died: Amnon, Absalom, and Adonijah. The promises to David went in fact to two of Bathsheba's sons, Nathan and Solomon. Second thing he does, I suspect he gets careless. With the return of the ark, Uzzah died, and now he becomes victim number 86 of David's actions, so 85 was with the priest of Nob, now that he's number 86. And I wonder if David wondered, Uzzah died for me, did he die for my sin? But there's a strange reaction which has not happened to them before, but did happen afterwards. Is that instead of fearing the Lord the right way, which is to honor and reverence him, you become afraid of him. There's a subtle difference between the two. He was scared to go to talk to Jesus. With that mistake behind him, he said, then sent the presence of the Lord away from him. And he passed the book, or rather he passed the ark, away to Obed-Edom, who treated that ark with respect, and he was blessed. Was David responsible for Uzzah's death? Not directly. But one thing we do know is that David made sure the job was done right the next time. In his thankfulness the next time to the Lord, he danced in a way that made raise the eyebrows of his stiff couple. I can well imagine what his reaction would be. Even here, which is probably fairly relaxed, if David came in like that, that's here. It's hard to imagine what the reaction would be. And we would not consider it appropriate in solemn assemblies that we have a church. Now, following that, Michael's reaction was quite natural. That's disgusting. And David made an insulting rebuttal. God chose me beyond your father, and you're not going to have any more kids. On the plus side, he distributes a good portion of food and wine for all Israelites, which probably about 3 million people. It's a major undertaking, as thanks to God's blessing, and probably it's reflected later in the feeding of the 5,000. Then he has this brilliant idea, this is the third point, he has this brilliant idea, why not build God a house? I'm well blessed, God, and I live in luxury, why does God just live around in tents? And your reaction would probably the same as mine, would probably the same as Nathan. What a wonderful idea. So he tells David that, it's a great idea. And God speaks to Nathan, Nathan says, sorry, no could do. And that was surprising us all. Now Now, what strikes me is how well he took it. What might be with what might we say if we are rebuffed? It comes with this great idea and it's thrown out completely, and you don't know why. David's reaction could have been, you can stick your temple, Lord. But it wasn't. Instead, he does all he can for his son to set him up with whatever he needed. I'm reminded of the time when Moses pleaded to the Lord about entering the land. And this was forgiving him over something really trivial, like striking a rock instead of speaking to it. And what God did tell Moses was to be quiet, not to bother him anymore with silly questions about that. And he told him to strengthen Joshua as his replacement. Now that's a humble attitude. Moses did it, David did it. There were very big-hearted actions by men to act in God's own heart. But do you not think they might have been avoided David's life? Dangers. There were other things like, was it really necessary to execute 2 out of 3 lines of Moabites, of whom David was a part of the family, and whom he sent David to, sent his parents to for safety? Was it really necessary to hamstring all those horses? Why was that cruelty? David could win both battles, and he was doing easily, as easily as switching the program over on your remote control. That easy. But it seems to be scratching around for ideas. The everlasting kindness he showed to David, to Saul, was now being used to look after Mephibosheth, his grandson. Now, David had to bury his prejudice Mephibosheth had led. He didn't actually play very well Mephibosheth for his honour, but David was very, very kind to him. Do you remember what he said? What can I do now for the house of Saul? Is there anything left for me to do? He was scratching around for ideas, and he did very well there. So David did great acts, but I suspect he had no purpose in life, or little purpose. And that leads to problems, and it did. So we're now coming to the period of the lapse. This, I think, was the thing that annoyed the Lord more than anything. And it's on record of how much he was displeased with it, except in the matter of Uriah. David was bored with the many easy military victories, it seems. And one day he couldn't be bothered to get up out of bed and go out and fight. And he finds a beautiful girl with whom he has his wicked way. We don't know whether he's looking for this sudden distraction or whether it happened by chance. But do you suppose at any time during the whole sorry business he prayed at all? You know the story. Uriah was a trusted soldier, almost a vision of Christ himself, who becomes victim there to Samson to result of David's deed. But there's that nasty subconscious feeling that you have when you really have messed up. When I kept silent, says David in Psalm 32, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long. He doesn't know what's wrong. David doesn't know until Nathan's famous words, thou art the man. That's 9 months down the line. 9 months of doing something wrong, but you can't work out what. That's the feeling of a prayerful man. Anyway, God has great mercy. He can remove all manner of sins. But do you suppose the part of that forgiveness is forgive as we forgive? And there was no one more forgiving than David over Saul. We've got victim number 88 now, David's first son by Bathsheba. David prays at last, but to no avail. When the boy dies, it seems as if a huge weight has been lifted off David. He washes and is clean. And yet more people sacrifice for David's sins. Conclusion to this episode, it's a real mess. But God is merciful to the uttermost to this man of God's own heart. He doesn't quite forget. He's aware of what's gone wrong. He mentioned it in many places. And the forgiveness, although it's absolute, it comes with its own problems. Which is our last episode. David's life is now a mess. But the old and lovely David is back. The whole business with Absalom is a confused, disjointed mess, and I don't like reading those chapters. But there it is. David, however, is amazingly forgiving to his wayward son. Then there was a crown, and the otherwise dreadful Joab says, "Get out to that battle which you told me to get your eye killed, or I'll take the city of mine." David does. And he takes the crown, which he wears nearly as much as he does. And I wonder if that heavyweight crown is a lesson about the burden of sin. Then there was a famine over Gibeon, which lasted 3 years. Surely David and his people feel a bit peckish by now, but why did it take 3 years to ask? The whole matter wasn't David's fault anyway, it was Saul's fault. But the whole business seems to have been engineered to remove the house of Saul bit by bit from being a threat. David was ever forgiving to a fault over Saul and Absalom, so God had to remove them all, one by one. And he even removed the lovely Jonathan, who wanted to be number two. I wonder if the Lord realised it was a threat there. The only remaining threat from Saul was Shimei. David, out of stupidity probably, swore to him to preserve him, which I think he regretted. So he then appointed Solomon to do his dirty work for him. Not good, that, is it? Then there was a numbering. This is, I think, it's where David loses all confidence in himself. Even the ghastly Joab knows it was a bad idea. That David's life felt really insecure. There were 70,000 more victims now. So the body count caused by David's actions was now 70,089. Due to David's sins or stupidity or desperation. You know what happens after that? He's afraid to see the Lord in mercy. That's what happens when you really, really mess up like that. This is a great man with David. You can see the fault and you can see how they might bring it up. He was a great, loving servant of the Lord. He did right and his forgiveness was boundless. But he got complacent, started making mistakes, including the big one. After this, things were never quite the same again. But at least he returned to becoming a forgiving person. And to a fault, maybe. Complacent or not, we can make big mistakes. But above all, let us love the Lord and our neighbour and be always ready to forgive, even to a fault. David writes for us, "And the heaven is high above the earth, so great is the mercy of God."